Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program titled Negotiating Hotel Management Agreements. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left-hand corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. Also, ladies and gentlemen, you are entitled to the CLE credits for today's webinar, and you will find the information in your handouts and on the second slide for the credits. I would now like to introduce our hosts for today's call. We have Karen Thiessen-Moyer and Matt LeMaster. You may begin.
Hello, welcome to Negotiating Hotel Management Agreements. Thank you for joining us. I'd like to just quickly, this is Karen Thiessen-Moyer, quickly show you the eligibility for CLE credit. If you have any questions about this, let us know after the presentation. We'll be happy to assist you with these credits if you are eligible. But moving right along. Like I said, I'm Karen Thiessen-Moyer. I'm counsel at Davis Wright Tremaine in our Portland office, and I'm joined by Matt LeMaster. He's a partner in our Seattle office, and we work together on various types of hotel and hospitality ventures. But today, specifically, we're going to be talking about hotel management agreements, which are, you know, lengthy and sometimes complicated documents that govern the relationships typically between the owner of the hotel or whoever has control of the real estate, maybe it's a tenant, and the manager that owner has selected to run the hotel on their behalf. And just to make it fun, we're going to make it a little controversial. I am going to represent the viewpoint of the manager, and Matt is going to represent the viewpoint of the owner as we talk about the different topics in today's slides. So,
and Karen, just to interject just briefly, I think the first thing is you can, if you send us an email in all lower caps or lower space, it'll still get to us. You don't have to do the cap M and L and M. And then the second thing is, the game is a little sometimes rigged, in the sense that the owners oftentimes don't have as much of experience as the brands do or the hotel management companies. So, but there's going to be certain hot button issues. Other times, the owners are very experienced, but probably in my experience, about probably 40% of the time, the hotel owners are coming into this as a new venture and don't have the typical experience that the counsel for the brands have.
That's often true. And then a couple just notes of other people who are tangentially at best involved in these negotiations and oftentimes have a front row seat, and that's the brand and the lender. So obviously the owner, you know, oftentimes can't purchase the asset or maintain the asset with their own cash funds and frequently get a lender. Lenders are increasingly savvy about these agreements and want very lender-friendly provisions at a minimum in the negotiation. Often the hotel management agreement is negotiated well before the lender enters the picture. So lender wants to come in and, if not make amendments, definitely have ancillary documents that we'll talk about later on and be very involved in that process. The brand, on the other hand, may or may not be at the table when this is done. The brand may be the manager. Sometimes the manager and the brand come as one complete package, and you get the brand along with the management. Sometimes the brand comes along as a separate franchise, maybe the same as the manager, but a different entity, and sometimes it's totally different entities. You have brand X, and you have independent manager that is not affiliated with the brand. But today, other than discussing how those other parties can influence some of the terms, we're going to be talking strictly about the negotiation and the relationship between the owner, as represented by Matt, and the manager, as represented by myself today. So let's start right off with the hotly negotiated topics. in these hotel management agreements. Pardon me. I'm a little trigger happy on the slides. Great. So first off, SNDAs, subordination, non-disturbance, and atonement agreements. This is a key document that absolutely involves the lender. So this is a document stating that the owner and the manager have kind of come to terms on the hotel management agreement. They've probably agreed and signed the agreement, and then a lender comes along. And this is a document where the lender is saying, okay, if the owner defaults for some reason under the hotel management agreement, it goes one of a couple ways. We want to have rights of the owner under the hotel management agreement, but some extra special rights too, maybe some termination rights, maybe some ability to change or make modifications or change where the money goes. And from the manager's perspective, the manager is trying to assert in the SNDA that if the owner does default under the hotel management agreement, that the manager wants to be recognized when the lender steps into the owner's shoes. So the HMA term, all of its material terms would continue as if the lender is the owner under the originally negotiated agreement. Matt, what's your perspective from the owner's side as to why this can be contentious?
So this is probably, from an owner's perspective, is the biggest deal because the owner wants to have an unfettered right to be able to go get financing and place financing. However, getting a loan is hard, right? Anybody who's bought a house knows that getting a loan is hard. And so the owner wants to get a loan, and one of the documents that the lender will put in front of the any party that has a significant interest in the subject hotel is the subordination agreement. And then you have the non-disturbance and atonement is something that gets negotiated at a subsequent time. But the where this comes up is in there's a covenant in the hotel management agreement that says the owner will acquire an SNDA or will exercise best efforts or sometimes it'll even be silent. And so if you're depending on the negotiating power, in depending on who is the management company, there can be an absolute requirement to have a non-disturbance and atonement agreement. And from the perspective of the hotel management company, this is fair because, you know, the hotel management companies are creatures of contract. And so if their contracts, the typical hotel gets traded probably, you know, every 5 to 10 years, and a hotel management agreement is a 20-year agreement typically. And so at some point during the life cycle, there is going to be a sale of the hotel. And further, the typical commercial debt out there gets refinanced every, you know, 3 to 5 years. So the rights at upon refinancing or rights upon sale are a huge deal. And just from the perspective of an owner who may have investors that they owe obligations to, the minimum requirements vis-a-vis the hotel manager are what's sought after. And any obligation that creates some sort of extensive right to have the non-disturbance from a lender is going to be mightily resisted.
And from a manager's perspective, why would I want to enter into a long-term agreement with you, owner, my partner, if you can't select lenders that would recognize my rights to be here? So you can see how it is a hotly negotiated topic, and it really does come down to relative power and negotiation in these agreements. On a similar note, other financing and lender requirements, it's virtually the same argument. Certain lenders are going to say ahead of time, I have to have a lockbox, I have to have this certain cash flow requirement, you need to deposit these funds in these places. And I think most managers are are okay with those terms as long as they're part of that process and it doesn't interfere with their ability to manage the hotel. But they certainly want to be aware of them and part of the negotiation when they're happening, as opposed to having them placed upon them after the fact.
Yeah, and so I've dealt, this is where it becomes very ticklish and important for owners to have advisors, either a business advisor or a consultant or a legal representative who has a lot of experience in this space. So for example, there are certain areas in the United States where people have an equity event and they think it's really cool to go, it'd be neat to go start a hotel or own a hotel. And develop a hotel in, say, the wine country of California or Washington or Oregon. And so they'll enter into a term sheet that has some of these technical requirements or some of these terms and conditions regarding the financing and lending requirements that the hotel management company imposes, because they haven't gotten their debt financing lined up. And basically, the horse will leave the barn. At a minimum, it's not necessary to fully engage legal counsel, or it's really, you know, at the discretion of the ownership group. But they should have a business consultant that is thoroughly aware of these issues prior to signing any term sheet with a hotel management company, so that they don't cause them a lot of pain going forward when they have to go out and find a lender.
Absolutely. So the next issue in definitely this category of hotly negotiated topics is termination rights, and that's a really broad category lately. It used to be there was a performance test, and if the manager failed both prongs of the performance test over 2 years, over certain hurdles, then the owner would have the right to terminate, but maybe subject to a cure by the manager. And that's certainly still a factor, but we're talking about all sorts of different termination rights now. The primary being an owner's right to terminate the hotel management agreement on sale, a for-cause termination that is outside of the performance test that may or may not be an event of default, and whether or not the parties want to plan for some of these events by having a liquidated damages clause saying, yes, we want the right to terminate you in these certain circumstances, and we were willing to pay for that right. And it's typically the owner paying the manager to go away, because that's usually how the flow of funds works. But managers are resistant or open to these options only if the liquidated damages make sense to compensate them for their amount of time, effort, and kind of lost brand, lost opportunity at this asset, and or whether or not it makes sense for them to continue to manage the asset. But sometimes the manager wants the right to terminate if the owner is unwilling to maintain the asset in the way that should represent that brand or that manager's ability to operate the hotel as needed for those brand standards, if it's quality or cleanliness or even life safety issues. So termination rights are definitely a huge part of the transaction and generally should be dealt with at a term sheet level. If someone's trying to negotiate termination rights outside the term sheet, you're kind of opening up a whole new negotiation strategy.
Well, in the term, so if I'm an owner, and let's say I've either I've developed a new property, or I've redeveloped a property, and I brought it up to some sort of standard, and I want to create an equity event. It is just a fact that I can get more money upon sale if I have the ability to sell an unencumbered asset, one of the encumbrances would be any contractual right. And so that would be our contractual liability or obligation, and that's a hotel management agreement. So the ability, and again, you know, I've done hotel deals where the owners actually develop the hotel and sell in 12 months after development, and so there's just a natural tension there, whereby the hotel management company has probably spent years, possibly scouting potential geographic regions where they want to locate a property, and then to and then they spend a huge amount of cost that they haven't received a return on their effort or return of capital, and then to have a termination right, so that that could be lorded over them by an owner. So the LDs have to match something of the amount of effort. Their liquidated damages have to have a correlation or relationship to the amount of effort that the hotel management agreement company endured to get the property up and running. But the owner is going to want to minimize those naturally, because it means more money into their pocket upon the sale.
And on the management side, the argument is certainly there are hotels that trade all the time where the brand never changes, the public never knows, and those are certainly at reasonable or high, if not better, than unencumbered assets PE ratios. So it's the flip side of whichever property you're looking at the time, but I can certainly see how both sides would want it their way. Intellectual property has become hotter these days with more and more boutique properties and independent properties. And kind of, you know, what the question is no longer what is a Marriott look or what is this look. It is kind of like what represents this brand, this independent or this boutique or this lifestyle that may or may not be designed specifically for this hotel. Is that owned by the hotel owner? Is that owned by the manager? And that becomes a real issue in hotel management agreements today as to who has that control after the manager leaves. And even while the manager is there, and can those rights or those design elements be used at other hotels potentially owned by the same owner but not managed by the same manager?
And from an owner's perspective, if the hotel management company, and so you're basically trying to come to some sort of accommodation and planning the divorce at the inception of the contract, and that's always a difficult discussion. And so the hotel will typically have these design elements and also have products that have the hotel management company's perhaps logo or other items that state who the hotel management company is. That's easy, and because those items just need to be used up. It's, you know, if there's been fixtures that have been embedded into the property or furniture in the lobby, you know, what's going to happen with that stuff? And generally, where the parties reside. This is a little bit lower if I'm representing an owner on the things that are going to get me all stirred up. But if I'm representing an owner, I just, on the day after the hotel management company leaves, you know, we'll go through the effort of deflagging and removing the inventory in a methodical manner and replacing it. And as long as we have a license to kind of keep the hotel continuing to operate in the past look and feel without, you know, having to rip out fireplaces and various design elements, we'll generally, that will be okay. It's where if you have something that's embedded where you have an obligation to rip it out, is definitely something that as an owner we're going to resist.
Great. Moving on to ratings restrictions. Historically, this went one direction. The owner wanted to limit the manager or the brand, if they were affiliated, other properties or potential competition in a certain market. And the market could be a 4-block radius, a 4-mile radius, sometimes a state or a geographic region for really iconic brands. And that has really morphed into all sorts of different innuendos of what's the breadth, what are the other limitations, can I have, you know, an Inn and Suites product but not an inn, can I have something that has a similar brand but is maybe a junior concept, you know, think of all the brands that are held by the major companies like Marriott. Think about the Marriott-Starwood merger right now. What used to just limit you know, 7 or 17 brands under one umbrella, it potentially does that now apply to all of the Starwood properties as well? So you can see how an owner could get a little itchy about something like that. On the other hand, a manager doesn't want to be hamstrung from their abilities to grow and expand. So this often is negotiated from a couple different perspectives, geographically, and what exactly is the limitation. And that can be, it needs to be very precise as to how it's defined in the hotel management agreement, and it needs to be upheld. It can't, it loses its meaning if it's not upheld in a strict enforcement. But we're starting to see it go the other direction now too, where some of these brands have a little more gumption and power, or these management companies or these iconic lifestyle things are saying, hey, look, I don't want you to own anything else here because we want to control this market, and people are coming to view our individual property here. So if you were to try to own another boutique lifestyle brand that's maybe not affiliated with us, we don't want that to interfere with our potential market demand. So they're definitely becoming negotiated on a new level that we haven't seen before. And moving on,
I don't have anything to add. You've hit the tension, Karen.
Great. And the last one on this slide is assignment limitations and approval rights. This absolutely applies to both parties. We typically see the manager getting very frustrated, and justifiably so, with an owner wanting the right to sell the hotel or assign their interests to someone who would be a competitor. So now the manager would have to potentially, you know, share documents and share operating agreements and talk with a competitor, and the manager's hands down is going to say, absolutely not. I cannot be forced to work for someone that I'd be sharing my trade secrets. And from Matt's perspective, the owner's going to be like, I need to be able to sell to whoever will pay for it. And so if you want to walk away, that's a whole other issue. So that becomes a very interesting perspective. And an owner's perspective, to put words into Matt's mouth, is, look, I hired you. I hired this particular group of people. I'm comfortable with this brand, this management. I don't want you to assign it to somebody else who may not have the same values or the same experience. So sometimes these loosen up over time. Sometimes that's a negotiated point. Sometimes it depends on the sale. Sometimes it depends on, at a minimum, you can't be affiliated with a crime family or something that's illegal or something that's not, or something that would hurt the liquor license or the prohibited laws in that area. It's kind of when you get down to brass tacks on it.
And I have nothing to add, except I want an unfettered right to assign to the third party, the contract to a third party. So I want to maximize value, and I want to maximize my approval rights over stuff on the property that I own. And generally, and this is one of the reasons why you want experienced counsel in dealing with these issues. There are places from that perspective that are in the middle that are the typical trades where people can settle. So
that's right. All right. Well, that's it. There are certainly other hotly negotiated topics. These are the ones we see most frequently and can kind of raise the blood pressure of the negotiation. But as to current trends in these negotiations, one of the ones that we're seeing most frequently is ownership identification. So the owner, like kind of Matt alluded to, there's all sorts of different ways of buying and funding real estate these days. And owners are sometimes a little cagey about being 100% forthcoming about who is in their makeup. From the manager's perspective, at all times, I want to know, for whom am I working? Who has the ability or the authorization to give me direction or to sign contracts or to sign off on approvals? And I want to know that that person isn't my competitor, isn't a prohibited person, isn't in jail, and has all sorts of authority that doesn't hurt my ability to manage this asset. And Matt, tell me why you think you would want the right to be a little clandestine about some of your ownership.
So I just want an unfettered right to bring to raise capital, because getting money is hard, and so and I may have obligations within my either a limited partnership agreement or just within my LLC agreement to maintain the confidentiality of my investor pool. To a certain degree, This is not a huge deal because any bank under the current transparency rules, such as the Know Your Customer rules, are going to compel the ownership group to disclose the significant shareholders or equity holders. And further, anytime you get a liquor license, there's also going to be a requirement to disclose your ownership group, or at least to the major ownership groups. But it, depending upon where you're at within in the cycle of the negotiation, I, as an owner, may be as counsel to the owner, may be directed to not give up this information sooner rather than later, and to be kind of difficult on disclosing this information, because my investor pool may not be socialized to both the Know Your Customer rules and to the liquor licensing rules. But as a general rule, ownership groups, depending upon their capital stack or their investors, people are going to want to have discretion with respect to their wealth, and so that's if I'm a sponsor, I have to be sensitive to that.
And coming back from the manager's perspective, I'm going to hound Matt's counsel to disclose that information to me as their partner in this agreement, and say, at a minimum, if you're not willing to disclose every person, I need frequent and updated covenants from you that these people are not certain people that would inhibit my ability to manage the hotel. And that's usually the kind of least favorite position from a manager, but sometimes what you have to go with these new types of financing arrangements. The next current trend is all about fees. And this shouldn't be anything new or dramatic. Fees change. There's kind of a general principle of a base management fee and an incentive fee, and whether or not there's a fee if there's a termination. And those used to kind of fit within nice little boxes. There was a range that you could call and say, hey, this is kind of the norm, and are we in the norm? And now we're seeing that these are just kind of totally open for negotiation depending on the parties. The manager is always going to set forth something pretty straightforward because that's what they're used to and they like. And owners are saying, hey, look, I've got this different ownership group. I have a different type of return that I need to do. I want to see a different type of pro forma. So what used to just be a percentage of gross revenue, you know, between 2 and 4%, we're seeing things calculated on everything from EBITDA to returns to defer fees until a sale. Like if you help me increase the asset to just paying expenses at the time. So expect to see the gamut. I'd still say a majority fall within kind of the traditional norms, but we're definitely seeing these all over the board. But again, this is a term sheet issue. This is not something that should be coming up in negotiating the document. You can get a little creative on some of the edges, but not the general concept.
Yeah, and so you know, with respect to the fee and the incentive fees, you know, this is a the practice area in dealing with hotel management agreements in the hospitality space is kind of a difficult terrain, and you can assume that the party that you enter into the contract will likely not be the party that you're looking to enforce a particular provision of the contract. So specifically, you know, I've seen it on the incentive fees where the party that the hotel's been conveyed, you know, 3 or 4 times when the incentive fee is due, and that hurdle has been achieved by one party or the other party. And so what that means is from a lawyer and a drafting perspective, I always encourage my clients, in particular, from both sides of the table, what I'm counseling an owner is, simple is truly better. And if you're trying to bootstrap into certain economic arrangements, such as incentive fees, there is an inherent risk there that somebody may have either misanalyzed the assumptions that go into the text, or the text has issues, or the other person on the other side of the table didn't anticipate the obligations under the text in the contract, and so that is ripe terrain for a dispute and ripe terrain for something like that we don't like in transactional practice, and that's litigation. So the net of it is if you know, keep it simple. But if you're gonna venture into these incentive arrangements, make sure that you use examples, you've used samples, you've used performas that thoroughly articulate how these incentive fees are going to be structured, or your high degree of probability you're going to be in the court.
Totally agreed. And this is a area where you definitely want the business advisors on both sides of the table to agree on that calculation and how it's done, and not just let it rely on the deal makers and particularly the lawyers at that time. Fees of termination is something we touched on a little bit on the hotly negotiated topics, but you know, from a manager's perspective, if you're given the right to terminate me for whatever reason, and there's going to be a fee due at termination, I sure as hell want you to pay that fee before I leave the hotel. I'm not going to give up all my rights to that money and hope to collect it 3 to 6 months later. So at a minimum, that's where a manager's saying, hey, you can't hold me hostage here. And I can imagine the owner saying, well, I don't want you here anymore. I want you to leave, and we'll figure out how to pay you later. So the parties definitely have to agree on how that's going to be paid and how that's going to be treated in the most amicable way without this becoming a precursor to litigation down the road. Moving on to kind of what's market right now. And, you know, it's intentional that we don't have numbers on this slide to say, hey, this is the market base fee, this is the market management fee, based on what we just talked about. These kind of vary all over the place depending on everything from, are you the preeminent asset in your city? You know, are you the preeminent brand in your city? Are you the coolest manager on the block right now? Which changes every 5 minutes potentially. Who has the relative negotiating power? But I certainly would want to know on either side what these numbers are. You need to be able to articulate this in your hotel management agreement. And hotel managers have a tendency to say, well, I'm going to charge you for centralized fees as a percentage of what you cost as a hotel in our system, and you would just write an invoice to the owner and expect the owner to pay it. That is almost universally rejected and treated with disdain. So come up with the range, give a sample, give a performa from a manager's perspective of how this works. But not all of these are charged in every agreement, branded or non-branded. Some of them will be considered mandatory. You have to pay into a centralized services. You have to pay into a group sales. Some of them are certainly optional, depending on what's going on with the project and are at owner's or manager's option, depending on the status of the asset. And the length of this agreement will certainly determine how and when these fees are calculated. And we find a lot of time is spent in the negotiation trying to cap or make minimums on these fees. Usually the manager wants it as a minimum, and the owner wants it as a cap. And sometimes that works, and sometimes that doesn't work. And sometimes, going back to Matt's example, sometimes the easiest way to deal with fees is, let's look at a performa. What are we forecasting for the hotel? Why does a cap or a minimum work here or not work here? Often I get the business person from the manager on the call that says, look, if you cap me to a 2% increase in this line item, that's $50. But in this line item, it's $50,000, so you have to have some sort of fluidity of how hotels are actually operated.
I think the fees, and just kind of a general comment on the hotel management agreements, I mean, the typical fulsomely drafted hotel management agreement, is about 50 pages long in 12-point type, and some of them can be longer. Some can be shorter, but they're a very thoroughly drafted document that has a lot of stuff that's going on over a 20-year period. And so not only do the fees need to be thoroughly thought out in a pro forma with a business consultant helping the ownership group, I think it's incumbent upon the attorneys to develop an abstract of the hotel management agreement. In particular, if the ownership group is not hugely experienced with hotel management agreements. And so the abstract is going to take the material terms and going to boil these down. Because remember, these fees are going to erode from the money that's going into the pocket of the owner. And so 5 years down the road, I've just seen it where the owner's, you know, confused and frustrated that they're not getting the money out of the property that they thought there was they were going to get out. And there are some scrupulous hotel management agreement, some operators out there that really kind of stick it to the owner as far as taking fees out. And so this is something that, and everybody wants to get the deal done, but this is something that needs to be thought through in detail, and the owner needs to get really comfortable and be willing to pay their advisors money so that in 10 years down the road, there's no confusion about the money that's either not coming out of the hotel or going for on the expense side.
Absolutely. On other market terms, you know, and all of this goes back to this concept between the relationship between these two parties. It's generally going to be long-term. It's got to be dealt with as, you know, not a legal partnership, but entered into a long-term agreement for someone else to take care of your asset. You know, this needs to be fair for both sides, as reasonable as possible, so, and a livable working agreement between the parties. And, like we said before, it's often got to pass muster with a lender and a franchise or a brand. So there's you can't come in as an unscrupulous operator and say, hey, I'm just going to try to take advantage of somebody that you're probably going to get caught in the crossfires at some point. So other market terms. Go ahead, Matt.
So and this is where I think, you know, particularly if you're a hotel, it is amazing the number of owners who are family-held businesses, and that the term of the agreement, the owner really needs to kind of blend and evaluate this in the context of where they're at in their own lives. What happens when they die? You know, have they created the ownership entity document, ownership document that will be able to account for a change of control in the ownership group? And are the other owners, the successors, whether they be business partners or children or family members or both, understand the hotel management agreement? Again, at its best, these are agreements that will last up to you know, 20 years, and I can barely remember what I was doing 20 years ago. So,
moving on to market terms, and these more market terms, talking about the term and what will affect how long this agreement is. We've talked about the number 20 kind of being a general term. That management agreement almost is always associated with a brand or a lifestyle or something where the manager brings a little bit more to the table than just management skill. So branded versus non-branded is a really big deal, and that could be a known brand or a consortium of brands or even independent names that are affiliated with these independent lifestyle operators. But an option period, it goes a long way in these agreements. You might have, you know, a shorter primary term with a whole bunch of options that are automatic, or who has the right to exercise? Can they only be exercised in the event that the parties are meeting certain thresholds? Do they have to have mutual approval at all times? Obviously, a manager wants them exercised at their option without approval from an owner. And then we spend a lot of time negotiating, what if the hotel has a fire or a hurricane, which we've certainly seen, and there's 20 or 15 or 10 years left on the term, the manager kind of wants the right to go back in there and continue to operate it after the hotel's put right. You know, and the owner might say, that might be my opportunity to rebrand or move a different direction. And a manager sometimes looks at that and say, I don't think that's your right at this time. You need to honor the benefit of our initial bargain. And then this new concept, which we're seeing more and more, of this manchise. For example, you have a management agreement that comes with a brand by either means of a franchise, or the brand comes with the manager, and the owner says, okay, I'm agreeing that you will be my brand and manager for this term. But on the event that I kick you out as the manager, or you leave, or there's a performance, or for whatever reason the manager is going to leave, the manager puts on their brand hat and says, fine, but this management agreement morphs into a franchise. So the public doesn't know that the manager has changed. The hotel will maintain its identity. It will maintain that it's a Marriott the whole time, and that could go on for 20, 50, 75 more years. Some of those franchise agreements can go a really long way, and it's at times the brand makes a decision that says, we really want this key strategic asset in this location to have our name on it, and we're okay if we have to step away as the manager as long as the name stays. So you're seeing that drafted into agreement saying, if we are kicked out as the manager, you will then have to apply for and approve the then current form of franchise agreement, which gets owners a little hot and bothered because they obviously want to review at the time that they're entering into it. And then the performance test impact. We talked about this a little bit before. It used to be 2 years, two hurdles, reasonable opportunity to cure. And now we're seeing, hey, look, if you're going to give me a 20-year term or a 5-year term, I want to modify my performance test. I want it to be a 1-year term. I want it to be an or test, not an and test. And the negotiation will hinge upon, well, how long is this agreement? Is the performance test likely something that can occur? If I can be terminated upon sale, I want my performance test to be a little bit lighter from a manager perspective. And then moving on to new things that are coming up all the time. So first, data security is huge right now, and has been for a long time, but we're seeing it more and more in the public eye as we've had major security breaches in different ways. But the first concept being guest data. So when you go to check into a hotel, you give them your name, your credit card, probably your address, maybe your email, maybe your firstborn kid's name. Who knows? You tend to just fill stuff out when you're checking into a hotel or doing it online through Orbitz or whatever. That data is there's typically provisions in your hotel management agreement about who owns that data and who has the right to use that data. Some of that, which is pretty generic, names, addresses, dates of stay at the hotel, should be equally shared between the owner and the manager. Some of it's the manager's considered proprietary. Well, every time Matt LeMaster checks into my hotel, he wants this kind of pillow and he orders this beer with his room service. That's something I've collected as a manager because I'm familiar with that guest. That's proprietary to me now. So I want to be able to cultivate Matt as a guest at my other hotels by offering him that same beer and that same kind of pillow when he goes somewhere else. And then you have to be very careful about the jurisdiction over what you can and cannot release based on the location of your asset. If the police come to your front desk and talk to your front desk agents and say, I want to know if so-and-so is staying here, you have to be very clear in your training about whether or not you can or cannot release that information with or without a warrant. And that can be specific down to your local city laws. And so that's where your local hotel association becomes very helpful in some of that education.
So the guest data, so from an owner's perspective, the guest data, there's a couple different issues, right? Because you're not, you're a wealthy owner and you just want to collect money. During the term of the hotel management agreement, there is an issue of how the hotel manager is treating it, and you want to be protected from mistreatment of that information so you don't get sued. We could actually probably do an all-day program on this specific topic. Suffice it to say is that you're going to have to create from an owner's perspective, sufficient contractual obligations by the hotel management agreement to do a good job. The second thing is, you, as an owner, you're going to want to make sure that the hotel manager agreement is not just contractually doing a good job, but also some assurance through training. And you're going to have to, you know, make sure and check on the manager and make sure they're actually taking care of their obligations. And then the third thing is that you're going to want to get your own insurance. A lot of owners think that, you know, they can just get an obligation by the hotel management agreement to provide insurance, and then they don't really have to worry about it. But this is something that you'll want to have an insurable risk and eliminate that obligation, and also have an entity that actually owns. So that's the fourth level of protection.
Yep, and it goes both ways. As the manager, I don't want the owner using the guest data to advance their own interests that are unrelated to the hotel. That's generally illegal in almost all jurisdictions. I don't, you know, I didn't opt into that extra marketing for the most part. Credit card security.
Just this really quick, Karen, and I'm sorry, I apologize for stepping on you a little bit, but just upon the termination, so what I have seen, though, is that the termination of the hotel management agreement, you know, what's a really bad outcome for the owner is that all the guest data is stripped out of the computers, and they don't have any idea who were their repeat customers or you know, who are their corporate customers. And so the owner, there needs to be some sort of covenant in the hotel management agreement about, and a discussion about, and there typically is, you know, 10 pages worth about what's going to happen upon the termination of the hotel management agreement.
100%. We all know about credit card security, and if you don't know credit card security, you need to get knowledgeable on that in the negotiation of your hotel management agreement and making sure that your manager is complying with the highest level of PCI DSS and making sure, and there's some new regulations coming out later this summer that everybody has to be on track with, because what has happened to Home Depot and Target has happened to Wyndham, has happened to almost every major hotel player out there. It just, the breaches haven't been as big yet, so we haven't heard about them on the news. But all of this being said, data security is really important. It has to be done, and you have to account for that in the costs of operating your hotel. A couple other new legal considerations. Like guest data, guest privacy is a big deal. I mean, we all saw the news with the Aaron Andrews verdict and the implications that has, not just on that particular hotel and that particular guest and that particular stalker, if you will, but the implication that's going to have a ripple effect in the industry. We're going to see a lot more liability limitations, discussions in the negotiation, like Matt talked about. How do the respective parties insure for this kind of for risk?
And I think from a hotel owner's perspective, and again, you could do, and Davis Wright Tremaine had nothing to do with that litigation and wasn't involved. But I think you can certainly, just by looking at the news, there was a lot of interplay between various contracts. And I think you could do a whole program on the various contracts in play. The net-net from an owner's perspective, because I think my own inclination is that there was probably some owner who really didn't have a super interest in the hotel who was asked to fork over a significant check. Is these contracts are important, and you really have to evaluate, you know, where the liability resides when something egregious, which I think anybody who looks at the facts of that litigation, the conduct of the hotel, and with respect to Ms. Andrews was really egregious. You really do have to look at these contracts and understand how they're going to flow for your own liability management if you're going to put your toe in the dip your toe in the pool of owning a hotel.
And then moving on, you should be. We're assuming you want to select competent counsel in negotiating the agreements. And two of the things that you can have the conversation with your counsel, and your counsel should be noticing, is what law governs the agreement. Maryland It just happens to be where Marriott's located and has been forever. And they are very influential with their legislature and have created very management-friendly policies and laws. So if your management agreement, the first draft, comes back that it's governed by Maryland law, talk about that with your lawyer and what that implication is. The general rule of thumb is that your hotel management agreement is covered by the state where the asset's located, but that's certainly negotiable. The second side that's much more owner favorable is agency law, which is, you know, a general legal concept of who has control. You know, the owner would hire the manager as their agent, and when that's an express obligation or found in law, then that comes with the manager then owes the owner a fiduciary duty. And the current trend of how to deal with this is try to make your management, if it's going to be expressly an agency contract, which is the general rule of thumb, try to have that agency limited to the four corners of the document, saying, yes, we appreciate that the manager is an agent here, but the parties have spent considerable time and effort negotiating this document, and we want this document to control, as opposed to being controlled by common law as determined by a court or other type of jurisdiction. And that can go a lot of different ways. That it's been a hot topic in the last 10 years because of a couple key cases. Typically, an agent can be fired for breach of its fiduciary duty without respect to the provisions in the agreement. It became a hot topic for four or five cases. It really hasn't come up again, but people are really nervous about this provision.
Well, it's not a hot topic right now because since 2010, this has been a glorious time in the hotel space, right? The properties, a lot of people were able to get into properties in 2008, 2009, 2010, for depressed prices, and then the equity has just exploded in a lot of markets or through the United States. So while the business environment is favorable, we're not going to be testing a lot of these hotel management agreement relationships. It's when things go sideways that these issues are going to get tested. As an owner, I want as many fiduciary obligations on behalf of the hotel management agreement or management company as may exist. You're never going to get an express statement of fiduciary obligation by a reputable and commercially viable hotel management company or well represented hotel management company, because that's just not. That would be a ridiculous covenant. But a fiduciary duty disclaimer would be something that I would resist if I'm representing the owner.
Great. And our last topic, and feel free to send some questions via the webinar if you'd like, or feel free to email us after. We'd be happy to address those. But we have one last topic, and that's this continuing to emerge trend of third-party restaurant operators. It used to be whoever managed your hotel managed everything, including the food and beverage, and that was super not successful for a long time, and they've really tried to flip the page on this. But this has some very significant implications for the relationship between the owner and the manager. Who gets to select that third-party operator? Who gets to approve who that person is? A lot of times the manager brings expertise in this area, has the quote-unquote cooler contacts, if you will, from their industry experience or other hotels they operate. But I would imagine that the owner wants some say in that.
So the third-party restaurant operations, so to the extent there are any owners on the call-in, it is a nightmare getting a viable restaurant at your property. There is every owner that has a full-service hotel who wants a cool restaurant, it is a real struggle to find that talent out there. Because somebody who has a spatula and can cook a nice meal may not be able to scale to your food and beverage operation to provide meeting space, to provide weddings, to do all the stuff you want to do in a full service hotel. So, you know, and a lot of times, particularly if you're doing new development, it may be a requirement in zoning to have a restaurant or to have other shop space in your hotel development or redevelopment. So this is something that needs to be really performed out. There needs to be the ability to very quickly fire and terminate your restaurant operator. I've seen on a number of transactions where the dream of opening a really cool hotel with a really cool restaurant is quickly becomes the most difficult thing to implement.
Yeah, and from a manager's perspective, I want to know that, like Matt said, who's controlling my room service, who's controlling my banquet space, and what if this restaurant no longer fits the model of what's happening in the hotel? You don't see a lot of Four Seasons with a McDonald's. You want to make sure that it kind of keeps up the look and character and feel. It talks about the brand standards, who would supervise the restaurant, and it's critical to talk about that fee structure, elements of that fee structure of that third-party arrangement in your hotel management agreement, because those funds will likely somehow flow through to the operator in one way or another by means of a lease payment that goes through to gross operating income or a management agreement, which may be a percentage of revenue or some other type of agreement. But that generally needs to be agree to agree on that in the future or agree to the terms now if it's known.
So just really quick, so we have 3 minutes left, and I think even this discussion kind of triggered, and there's a segue of other programs that we could do, and there's just an area of law and commercial practice that's just is issue upon issue upon issue. So we don't have a lot of time for questions. But I think we actually have one question, Karen, you can touch upon it, but I also want to, go back, if you go back to the first slide and you can do it all in all lowercase, you can please feel free to send Karen and I a question at any time and we'll answer it and we won't even bill you for it, or at least Karen won't.
Very generous, Matt. Thank you. We have a question about crowdfunding hospitality projects and why or why not to do that. Number one, I think crowdfunding is certainly a hot topic. There's a lot of regulation on how it's done and how you make those securities offerings, which is they still are in fact securities offerings for crowdfunding, and every jurisdiction has its own rules for that. Sometimes it's hard to get enough people in crowdfunding on a hotel because you're talking about a lot of dollars that are needed. But I think the other side of it is whether or not it generally takes a lot of time and whether or not that will impact your relationship with other lenders. Where will the crowdfunding money slot into the capital stack? What does that do to the relationship with your manager? Your manager certainly, isn't going to want to dig into every single individual, but your franchise brand certainly might, depending on where that capital stack layer is. So it can be challenging, but so far we haven't seen crowdfunding at the hotel level to come up with enough money to justify, multi-million dollar assets, which doesn't mean it's not coming. I certainly think that people are trying to do that, and that's probably the next wave. But so far, we need to find the way of making it a more attractive option in our local jurisdictions of how to get it done, because usually crowdfunders are not putting up millions of dollars at a time.
Yeah, and the only thing I would add is that, anytime you do a sources and uses analysis and doing a development deal, you're going to have the debt and equity side, and the debt side's got to get comfortable with what's going on the equity side. And the other question becomes relevant is if there's an additional requirement for capital calls, So to me, never is a really long time, so I won't say never with respect to crowdfunding. I just think that there's some inherent challenges. I think the marketplace probably needs to work through some of those challenges, and I'm just healthily skeptical that there's an application in really large, complex transactions. And I guess that's a good place to stop. It's 11 o'clock.
Yep. Thanks, Matt. I appreciate you joining me this morning, and thank you, attendees. Please, we appreciate you being on with us for this hour, and we do encourage you to contact us if you have any questions, and if you have questions about the content or questions about CLE credit. Thank you, and have a good day.
Thank you.
And this concludes today's webinar, and thank you for attending.